Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Souls' weekly two-hour study of the Urantia Papers. We are seeking to grasp the fifth epical revelation in a synthetic wholeness. Tonight, paper 49, section 2, item 15. It's number 2 in the enumerated list. It's our ark, our local system of inhabited worlds. Said Jesus, "But I have many other sheep not of this fold, and these worlds are true not, and these words are true not only of this world. These other sheep also hear and know my voice, and I have promised the Father that they shall all be brought into one fold, one brotherhood of the sons of God." That is from the Urantia Book, paper 165, but it's also in John 10, chapter 10, verse 16. I'm Brad Garner. So glad that you're here with us live or in our archive at symmetryofsoul.org. With us tonight is Dr. Chris Halverson, Andrea Barnes, Justin Armstrong, and you. Won't you join us in our study by taking your virtual seat, calling up the text to the Urantia Papers, and let's get going on this wonderful study. Good evening, Dr. Chris.
Good evening, Brad. That was a fun quote to bring in since we're going to explore just how curious some of those other inhabitants of those other worlds are. Great thought to bring that in. And welcome to you, Justin, and to you, Andrea, and everyone who's joining us. We have lots of those variations of mortals in the flesh types to go through here yet tonight. And then we'll cap off the broadcast with probably everyone's favorite radical type, the non-breathers. So it should be a very exciting show, and I hope everyone gets a chance to really let their speculative juices flow a little bit about all of this diversity of the cosmos.
Yeah, it's easy for a guy like me who grew up on science fiction, and here we have some science fact. So this is delightful stuff. Very, very perspective enlarging to understand. Not only are we not the only inhabited world out there, but the other inhabited worlds, there's a purpose to them that is like the purpose to ours. What a revelatory perspective we're gifted with here. And Andrea, good evening to you. How's everything out your way?
Good evening, Brad and Chris and Justin. Everything out here is just great. We've had a nice, lovely, warm spell and been able to be really active. So tonight is one of my favorite sections, and I'm really looking forward to the discussion. I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Definitely. I would imagine that this is one of those sections, if a new reader were to open up to the contents of the book and just try to look for something they have an affinity for, there's a certain type of prospective reader that would be drawn to a paper titled The Inhabited Worlds, plural. Like, well, that ought to be interesting. And they're off to the races. And Justin, good evening to you. We are glad to have you here again as one of our regular ongoing co-hosts, and also grateful that you put in some time and summarized what we were up to last week. How are you, sir?
I'm well. Good evening, Brad, and good evening, Dr. Chris and Andrea. And, yeah, I have a review for everyone, so let's get started here. Eternal life provides countless opportunities for the utilization of our God-given potentials. The paradise ascent is filled with insecurities and recurrent uncertainties, and the challenges ahead must be courageously and independently embraced on a personal level. We must truly desire our destiny, our highest conceptualization of a transcendent God, and face the challenging facts contained within the journey. The potential for hope resides within the process of perfectingness. Lucifer protested against the age-long program of preparing the mortals of space for some unknown destiny and challenged and condemned the entire plan of mortal ascension. What Lucifer failed to recognize is that when a mortal genuinely aims high, they possess a quality that is bound to the eternal. They develop relationship between material mind and divine spirit, a relationship which connotes a value and carries a meaning not found in either of the contributing factors to such an association. This relationship is what the midway creatures call the midmind, or the soul. We read in paper 111, section 2, paragraph 8, the following. The midway creatures have long denominated this evolving soul of man the midmind, in contradistinction to the lower or material mind and the higher or cosmic mind. This midmind is really a Mirantia phenomenon, since it exists in the realm between the material and the spiritual. The potential of such a Mirantia evolution is inherent in the two universal urges of mind, the impulse of the finite mind of the creature to know God and attain the divinity of the Creator, and the impulse of the infinite mind of the Creator to know man and attain the experience of the creature. We must each ask ourselves the following significant and consequential question. Will the afterlife provide me an opportunity to once again enjoy Grandma's biscuits? Store up your treasures in heaven was a simple phrase that Jesus used to remind us that the mind that awakens upon resurrection is the mind of the soul, not the material mind. We should challenge ourselves to be motivated in a way that transcends the current moment and place. Revisiting the splendid taste of Grandma's biscuits in the afterlife is a figment. Our proper motivations are rooted in both genuine fact and genuine goodness, leading to the superadditive consequence of truth. Always hunger for truth, not merely Grandma's biscuits. Humanism is focused on temporal progression. Religion is focused on eternal progression. Humanism on progressing the temporal adjutant self. Religion on progressing the Mirantial self, your potential immortal self. Our faith nucleus is the fulcrum point through which what we do below is reflected into the soul. We must seek true religion, for true religion is insight into spiritual and eternal values. We began our reading in paper 49, section 0, The Inhabited Worlds. All mortal inhabited worlds are evolutionary in origin and nature. Our native sphere is a training school. Everything we encounter here and now is merely in preparation for a potential upward orientation towards the next life. Learning is the first thing we will be doing and the last thing we will be doing in the local universe level, and the process simply repeats on the super universe level. The things and beings on the system level are a downstepped expression of the things and beings from each Avona world, as above, so below. As evolutionary worlds progress farther into light and life, they are administratively transcending local system administration. Administration starts on high, works its way down to the system level, and then seeks to reach back towards higher origins. Symmetry of Soul suggests that worlds, when engaged by beings, might be evolved in batches of roughly 200 worlds per system, or 5 batches per system. This estimate provides a framework to reflect upon the complicated logistics within system administration. Evolutionary worlds are not naturally suitable for life. They all must be terraformed prior to life implantation. This allows for the potential appearance of will creatures on an inhabited world. Section 1, the planetary life. Everything is mind-made and personality managed. True scientific theory must generate a sphere of understanding that produces predictions that are correct. The biologic unit of material life is the protoplasmic cell, proto being primary and plasm being formative material. The primary formative material is fundamentally individuated, and it has a communal association due to being over-controlled by mind. At the system level, the material sons and daughters, being the offspring of the Creator Son, are attuned to the life pattern of their respective system. The life carriers are the offspring of three pre-existent personalities, the Creator Son, the Universe Mother Spirit, and by designation, one of the three Ancients of Days presiding over the destinies of the super-universe concerned. The chemical formulas differ in each system, allowing the worlds within each local system to disclose unmistakable physical kinship. This physical kinship provides a context in which the material sons and daughters from above can interface with all system variations of human life in accordance with law and order. The local universe also has an individuality, and the technique of living cell reproduction is slightly different within each local universe. There are two phases of living cell reproduction. The first phase, the living vitality, is common throughout the local universes because it is fundamentally transcendent of the specificity of a local universe. One of the reasons the life carriers have an Ancient of Days as a third parent is to provide a foundation for this transcendent influence of Mother Deity. The second phase, the reproductive spark, is conditioned by each local universe's creative mother spirit, allowing an influence of both spirit and mother deity at the local universe level predicated on her nature. The life carriers allow for planetary variations, however, they are not capricious nor whimsical. Prior to the arrival of a planetary prince, they provide a physical foundation based upon law and order. And after his arrival, he continues to promote law and order in both mindal and spiritual levels. There is an over-control, top-down influence upon all aspects of physical evolution. The process is orderly and controlled. In this context, we should thirst for righteousness and strive to align our purpose with the divine purpose of the Universal Mother. Section 2. Planetary physical types. There are seven distinct planetary physical types. 1, atmospheric types, 2, elemental types, 3, gravity types, 4, temperature types, 5, electric types, 6, energizing types, 7, unnamed types. The first 6 types impact the intellectual or spiritual life. However, the 7th, or unnamed types, are variations in planetary life that do not influence intellectual or spiritual matters. Atmospheric density has a significant influence on our mindal and spiritual nature, yet the other 5 influences are relatively minor. Our world is almost ideal for the support of the breathing type of man, and we are classified as mid-breathers. In Satania, about 2.5% are sub-breathers, about 5% are super-breathers, and over 91% are mid-breathers. 1.5% are non-breathers. The non-breathers represent a radical or extreme adjustment to planetary environment, and you would be more than interested in this type of mortal because such a race of beings inhabits a sphere in close proximity to Urantia. And there ends the summary.
All right. Fantastic, Justin. Thank you so much for putting the time in and well read. I wish that I could adopt the kind of pacing that you give. You let the words and the ideas breathe there. I'm a bit frenetic usually. But hey, I dig your style, man. That's cool.
Thanks, Beth.
I thought it was really cute about bringing Grandma's biscuits into the story.
isn't Brad responsible for the biscuits getting into the conversation here?
Yes, that's mm-hmm. Brad's addition, yes.
I'll see if I can drop a photograph onto the website just to spice up your summary a little. Throw in some biscuits on there.
can you make it so when they go to the website they can smell the biscuits too?
That's what I was wondering, Chris.
I think some of our top technology billionaires are working on that very thing right now. More reasons to never leave your home.
Right.
Oh.
All right. Well, any thoughts or clarifications from anyone?
You know, it occurred to me when you were doing that kind of little mini essay at the beginning to summarize our extensive conversation that we did at the at the beginning of the last broadcast, that it's you know, it's totally appropriate that you would touch upon the issue of you know, various fanciful notions about the afterlife, you know, or you know, life in heaven, since you know we're in paper, you know, beginning paper 49, and if you just drop back to the beginning of paper 48, you know, so the preceding paper, you know, has that classic line in the second paragraph of the preface of that paper, when they're talking about notions of the afterlife, and you know, that line about such beliefs are but ignorant superstitions and pleasing fables. You know, many times I, especially the pleasing fables part, you know, I'll kind of toss out that expression. If people have wondered where that comes from, if they didn't know, that's where it comes from, there at the beginning of paper 48. So, yeah, it is a behind the scenes preface to what we're doing, and you know, getting into all of the nitty gritty of the facts of reality, you know, is to kind of start at the foundation and you know, completely transform your concept frame and you know, ultimately not allow any room for ignorant superstitions and pleasing fables, and begin to be instead of just an imaginative fancy animal, to begin to be a fact-based human in your approach to your life and to the cosmos.
Yeah, I think there's the risk with the fifth epical revelation of having a whole new galaxy of pleasing fables about the afterlife, because we've been giving some of the details. We've been covering a lot of those here. You know, the circles, the squares, the triangles, the physical aspects, the lighting and the heating. I've gotten older, I've had to sort of refine my thoughts on, yeah, I wonder what day one would be like there. And, you know, when you're a kid, you're like, well, just, sorry to bring up grandma again, but it's like, well, I get to see grandma again. And yes, that may be true, but, you know, you may not remember grandma, and grandma might not remember you, and you might be resurrecting at the same time, and she's not going to look like the 80-year-old woman you knew. And, like, so just that pleasing sentimental thing of like, oh, I just, it can be just like I was 9 years old again, and she'll just take me in her lap. I'm like, no, that's not coherent with the facts. It's going to be amazing, but get over some of those new fables that we have here that you could get from the Urantia book.
Yeah, that individual was not resurrected, or will not be resurrected, depending on the time here. As we were stressing, and Justin was reminding us from our opening discussion last week there in the review, you know, it's that Urantia mindful self that's resurrected. And one can ask, well, let's see. I mean, what do you suppose a body would look like if it was constructed to match grandma's Urantia mindful self? Right? It's not going to look like the body that was attuned to the grandma you remember, the agitated mindful self grandma. You know, not to mention, in a biologic sense, that Urantia self isn't your grandmother.
Right. Right.
You know, so again, you know, this it's a pleasing fable to think that you know, there's just some sort of magical uplift of all of the agitated mindful selves and their bodies, you know, to continue the play in heaven. That's not reality. You know, that always has been and will forever be ashes to ashes, dust to dust. You know, that whole stage play that we are very much aware of here in this life, that doesn't pick up where it left off. That ends.
You know, on some level, when you try to think of the essence or the nature of a person versus sort of these outward qualities, one thing that comes to mind for me is the voice of a master composer. And you listen to Mozart or you listen to Bach or Beethoven, and clearly throughout their entire career, somehow, regardless of what period, mid-period, late period, you're hearing the voice carry through all their different compositions, regardless of the level of complexity, the length of the composition. So there is almost this sort of downstepped mode where we can kind of imagine, oh, there's something, there's some essence that you can pick up on a person, even in the way that they meaningfully craft music.
Yeah, and just, you know, reflect upon that and how you have to be discriminating. You know, it could be, let's kind of go forward. Yeah, you take some popular band, of the 20th century, 21st century, and you could, it may be that the reason that, there's a recognizable commonality amongst all of their songs, is simply because, their biologic, framing, is welling up every time and framing the song, right? So it sounds the same, not because of some transcendent superposition,
sure,
but just, an underlying drone tone of biologic nature. But yeah, the question is, if you take a musician that you suspect might be more than just an individual that can musically express their biology, is there an actual human commonality, downwelling and framing each composition?
Yeah.
In general, when especially if people, romantically think about, the statements in the Celestial Artisans paper, to recognize that that's what you're looking for. Someone who will have such significant, kind of never before seen human character, that they can produce this cosmically beautiful framing of a musical composition, so that it speaks, the harmony of the cosmos, as opposed to the resonances of their biology.
Hmm. It's an interesting contrast. Makes you wonder what, if anything, we've ever heard down here that really matches that high bar that they're setting for us here. Bound to be something here or there. Huh.
And it would, fundamentally, when a human engages that cosmic-sourced music, one first engages it in a very holistic, reflective thinking. And then you would feel it emotionally.
Yes.
As opposed to feeling it emotionally and there you are stuck in that emotion. You can't get above the feelings, to the thoughts that lead you Godward.
Well,
unless it hits you on like an unconscious level and the emotions take over before you can figure out what's going on.
Well, again, the point of a recognized presentation of cosmic harmony is that it would be completely super emotional, that recognition, and it would be wholly conscious.
Okay.
You would be aware of the accuracy of the presentation of a phase of the cosmos. You know, and then in consequent to that conscious recognition, you know, inescapably, because of our nature here, you would have an emotional response to that. A very deep emotional response, most likely. But, you know, again, it's all in that, it's your thoughts, not your feelings that lead you Godward. And, you know, and specifically what kind of thoughts they're talking about there. Right? They're not just, you know, rumination thoughts. Below the level of the feelings, their thoughts completely transcended to the levels of the feelings. And it's in those thoughts that you eventually become God-knowing. It's in those thoughts that you know the truth. It's in those thoughts that you become born again. It's in those thoughts that you wear the robe of righteousness. All these things that have to do with the reality of a real life and an afterlife, as opposed to ignorance, superstitions, and pleasing fables.
I understand.
Well, it's a very, very helpful way to try to frame an informed reading and study of this revelation, so that we don't falsely exalt something that's actually just very temporal, very of this world, and particularly things that are, you know, really, they're really close to our animal origin selves, like, you know, things we're very fond of here. I'm not just talking about biscuits. I mean, I'm talking about my favorite music. I'm like, I'll be able to listen to all that band up on high, or the music better be at least as good as Pink Floyd. I'm like, well, what a crude comparison. Would say the archangel of
The archangel. I don't even have words to begin to express the the grossness of that thought, Brad.
right.
Unless you see him at a concert, and then let me tell you.
Right. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah, but again, you know, it touches upon, you know, this question that we're so often puzzling over. It's like, well, what exactly is it that produces treasures in heaven instead of on earth, right, that Jesus was talking about? How do you access that phenomenon, you know, that process of storing up treasures in heaven? This is the key. I mean, if it's not reflective thinking, you know, there's absolutely no mechanism to store treasures in heaven. I mean, mere feelings or you know, just animal origin thoughts don't store one iota of treasure in heaven.
There's a reference,
pure temporal,
that touches upon the storing of treasures in heaven from 1:10:6. It's pretty short, but I'll share it. The motivation of faith makes experiential the full realization of man's sonship with God, but action, completion of decisions, is essential to the evolutionary attainment of consciousness of progressive kinship with the cosmic actuality of the Supreme Being.
And again, anything that of consequence that, you know, to an ascension career that they're talking about in the entire revelation, it is only accessible in the, you know, in the frame, in the space, in the context of reflective thinking, because that's the only part of your thinking that has any relationship whatsoever with eternity.
Yeah, there's no comprehension.
All the rest of your life, not only does it not store up treasures in heaven, it gives you not the slightest indication of the nature of that Marantia self that's going to be resurrected. Your Marantia self is a copy of the part of your current adjutant self that, you know, reflectively thinks. The rest of it is dust in the wind. You know, and so again, you can just, if you're wondering, you know, what part of me is going to be resurrected? Well, it's that reflective part of you and nothing else.
And in that part of reflective thinking, there's a comprehension of supreme meanings, not just a bottom-up material more system version of meanings. It's literally a comprehension of supreme meanings that's finding its way into those reality responses, the recognition.
That's the heights of it, you know. But, you know, the depths of that is, you know, just that immediate super animal reality. Right? It goes from the immediate, you know, we could even say supra, you know, I mean, just immediately over, not even, you know, above to any degree, but just immediately over the animal. You know, that's the beginning, and it goes all the way up to supremacy. You know, that's the human you. That's the part of you that, you know, has potential immortality. Any thoughts at the animal level or below are not solvable.
Well, all right. Well, thanks for the discussion. I had one point that I wanted to bring up, at least my own take on things. I was noticing in the reading that we had last week, there's a whole sentence that is italicized. Sometimes I can get on a typography kick. And, you know, usually there's 2,500 some odd instances of italics in the book. So they're used to great effect for emphasis, but it's relatively rare that they'll italicize an entire sentence. Sometimes they do if they're repeating it, what Jesus said over in part four. But this sentence kind of stands. It's a notable full sentence italics. Mortal man is not an evolutionary accident. And, of course, if you've read the book for a while, you can just say, well, I get that. That's kind of one of the main points you're trying to make here, which, yes, that may be why it's italicized, but I just spent some time looking at it. Maybe I wasn't reflecting. Maybe I was ruminating. But I'm like, you know, we can take this for granted, but that sentence has not been spoken with the full depth of meaning, really, before here on our planet. We entered the 20th century with a concept of evolution. It was a huge fad in the mid to late 19th century in the West. And we entered the 20th century with it, but it was godless evolution, which is no evolution at all. To say that mortal man is not an evolutionary accident, that is a revelation. I mean, it unfolds in 2,097 more pages, but that is a very deep statement. If you could just convey the depth of that meaning, you know, in the beginning, God created evolution, it could help clear up so many thoughts. It's not a silver bullet. Some people are very entrenched these days, but I really appreciated that sentence being there and that they hit it that hard with a full stop.
Brad, I'm glad you. Oh, sorry, Chris. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it has a double-edged purpose, which I think you're kind of getting at there. Yeah, just within the context of the revelation itself, you know, it's a very definitive, foundational statement. You know, that in the context of the revelation, you are reading about, you know, the design of life, you know, like we're doing here very specifically in paper 49. And one of our keywords is life design diversity for this broadcast. And so, you know, they want to emphasize that concept so that you firmly have the correct foundation. But like you're indicating, I mean, you know, there's two sides to that. It also is very important to emphasize that because you need to recognize that, I mean, not only what you were talking about at the beginning of the 20th century, by the time you get to the middle of the 20th century, you have neo-Darwinism.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
You know, it's even more abysmal. I mean, we've all been marinating in that abomination, you know, our entire lives. And you should be constantly pounding on yourself, right, with that sentence to drive that out of you. You know, because it has this endless, corrosive, godless consequences in your mind if you let even the slightest bit of evolutionary accident, you know, that's thrown at you from every direction all the time, creep into the framing of your mind. You know, you have to aggressively purge that insidious, you know, materialistic, humanistic, secularistic virus from your mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
It seems that you really do have to work on it, and but it seems to be, you know, become more and more clear to the point of you've cured yourself of that virus.
I mean, there's so many things that someone will tell you that are false, because even if it doesn't seem like it, they started with the assumption that not only man, but all life is an evolutionary accident. And so if you listen to that voice, you say, oh, well, that's a really smart person. So that's a definitive basis for my thinking about things, what he's saying there. It's like, no, it's not. Because you can follow that back to the abominable assumption that it's all just a magic upwelling out of magic matter.
Yep.
You know? In a godless reality, right? Which when all is said and done, is the first principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. You might want to, you know, steer clear of that. Okay? You know, you can see how, you know, how it corroded Lucifer's mind. It's highly corrosive. And it needs to have absolutely no place within you.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's why it's the whole thing is italicized. It's a very important sort of touchstone. Right, of to see to the purity of your mind.
I appreciate that you brought that up, Brad. And I also was thinking about it this morning, actually, not that specific sentence, but the concept in general. And I also appreciate, Chris, last week's study, the emphasis that you placed on the over-control, as well as this concept of everything being based upon law and order. I kind of think of it in two parts, almost kind of like hardware and software. The nuances that they were touching upon in last week's study regarding the variations that the life carriers have to work with, when you look at the literal genetic sequences themselves and whatnot, I kind of think of that as more like the hardware side of the equation. But behind what they're doing on that mere level, there's this overarching, all-encompassing mother deity over control software influence that's also engaging all the parts and coordinating them. So simultaneously, there's seeing both influences paints a much fuller picture to describe why mortal man is not an evolutionary accident.
Right. The life carriers have to potentialize the matter just so in order for that, you know, that downwelling influence to evolve it. It's that evolutionary influence isn't magical. It can only evolve that which is evolvable. I mean, for instance, you know, it can't evolve prokaryotes, right? And, you know, and you have, you know, full-on living matter with DNA there. Right? It has to be eukaryotic life in order for it to be evolvable. You know, and just, you know, there's a statement that flies in the face of, you know, what a evolutionary biologist believes, right? They think it's all the same, and it's like, no, prokaryotes is not evolutionary life, right? And that prokaryotic life was on this planet, you know, hundreds of millions of years before evolvable life was implanted. Right, by the life carriers.
Yeah. That's something I missed on my first couple of read-throughs. Yeah.
Yeah. So just, there's, kind of just again, what I was saying, there's just so many, ways that our minds have been conditioned in an unfortunate fashion. And one has to get very aggressive with oneself in order to find the truth of the revelation, because there's just countless things that prevent you from seeing what you need to see, from recognizing what you need to recognize. There's a surround sound insidious influence that you've been marinating in your whole life that biases your starting point away from what it needs to be that eventual ascending son of God. If you can do that beginning step of entering the kingdom of heaven, and you can, and if you make it to the mansion world, like we've said, those first two mansion worlds especially are designed to finally get you liberated from all of this unfortunate baggage that, like I was just saying, means that you could never become an ascending son of God. It's just, you have to be purified of all that so that you are ascendable first, right? And then the ascending influence will begin to ascend you. But you can't be ascended when you're not ascendable. And something that is still, laden with this baggage is not ascendable.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why you have that definitive, when you are finally fully ascendable, you fuse. Right? And you become ascending son of God. But before that, there may be a truth to your ascension, but there's not really a fact to it yet. And, you can be labeled a faith son of God.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. But again, back it up, like I was saying. I mean, first things first, are you really a faith son of God? Okay. We've talked about that endlessly. And, and that gets back to this italicizing, mortal man is not an evolutionary accident. You can't have parts of your mind unwittingly assuming a godless predicate. Right? Without God, there is nothing. Right? And so, see, if you have a godless predicate for any part of your mind, you have a nothing for that part of your mind as a predicate. That mind is really nothing. No matter how much it appears to be something, it isn't really anything. Because without God, there is nothing. Sine Deo Nihil.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So again, it's just very important, to see to that, the purification of that foundation of your mind, to get this insidious virus, right, of the materialistic, humanistic, secularistic world that you've been marinating in, completely out of it. Almost all of it is, you don't even know it's there, right? You've never even been aware of its existence. You have to become a reflective thinker so you can become aware of those, otherwise unknowable foundations of your mind. You have to become aware of the framing of your mind, right? Which only a reflective mind can do. Otherwise, it only knows the contents within the frame. knows not the frame. And the frame is what determines whether or not you survive or not. You know, is it framed with eternity or is it framed with time? You know, and again, in this life before you serve two masters, there's a part of your mind that you can't frame with eternity. Right? And that part is not resurrectable. Like
right.
What we're talking about.
That,
but you've been given, you know, a part of your mind by grace that is eternity frameable. You know, and it was initially framed with eternity unless you've messed it up. And see, that's the part you want to see to.
There's a short, really short little YouTube clip on Carl Jung, and they ask him if he believes in God. And he pauses for a moment and he says, belief, I have a hard time with that word, I know.
Yeah, but none of us can start out with God knowing. Right? That's adult of God. You know, so we have to start out as a child of God, you know, in quest of God knowingness. Right? Really in quest, you know, that's what real faith is the real beginning of that real quest for real God knowingness. And again, see, it's all, you know, think about the basis of what I just said. It has nothing to do with time. It has nothing to do with matter. It has nothing to do with the rest of mankind. It has to do with the spiritual, the personality manageable part of your mind. It has to do with the divine. It has to do with eternity. That's the part that you were given the potential to have by grace. You need to carefully conserve what was initially given and take delight in cultivating the growth of more. And then you're a faith son of God.
Yeah, and keep that animal origin self, see it for what it is, that second master. You know, it's something that needs to be parented. It doesn't need to be in the driver's seat. It needs to be in the passenger seat in a child's seat. And you just need to see it for what it is.
Right. A genuine religionist is attempting to never let the child be the parent. That's what makes them a religionist.
I like that.
To never let the lower domain, right? Yeah, be the foundation or the last word. But the upper domain in the hourglass analogy, the personalized self, the spiritualized mind, the part that was created in you, not the part that was born. The child was born. The potential parent for that child was created. And it's sad to record that so few persons take delight in cultivating the parent and the parenting of the child. Right?
Even though the child won't survive.
Yeah, see, again, it's that can be resurrected. The child can't.
Yeah.
It's like, why even bother with the child then? It's like, because if you don't control it, it will backwash and destroy the parent. Right? Yeah. Like we've talked about. You will spiritualize falsely that animal origin nature and cut yourself off from eternity. You need to control that, keep it in its place, as a servant in time.
Okay.
Well, you're the master in eternity.
All that from paper 49. All right. It's amazing what we can kind of think about. I thought we were just talking about, little gray aliens, but no, so much more.
Everyone wants to get to Section 3. We're still in Section 2, folks. What is Section 2?
I know.
Robert?
speaking of those little aliens, let's get with the reading tonight, I guess. Yeah, thanks for the discussion as always, everyone. Terrific. All right, so we're reading paper 49 tonight in the Urantia Papers. That's the Inhabited Worlds. And we are in section 2, Planetary Physical Types. And we started this section last week. We are picking up at what we would call item number 15 in the standard reference text. That's enumerated item number 2, the elemental types. We last week covered item 1, the atmospheric types. Now we're on to the elemental types. That's on page 561
page
of the original. Oh. Yeah, 561 of the original single column text. Number 2, the elemental types. These differentiations have to do with the relation of mortals to water, air, and land, and there are 4 distinct species of intelligent life as they are related to these habitats. The Urantia races are of the land order.
Yeah, so, you know, elemental, you're almost thinking, wait a minute, is it going to be earth, water, air, and fire? no, not quite. But close, right? Let's remind everyone up front. It was Justin brought it up in the review there in passing, but you know these named types that we're going to be studying here are the types that impact the intellectual or the spiritual life. In contrast, all the other types, the quote-unquote unnamed types, right, they're named, you see, because of how consequential they are, okay, you know, ultimately to, you know, these thoughts about ascending, right, you know, or even getting off the ground, right, an intellectual life above a mere animal origin mentality, you know, and then a personality managed, a spiritual life, right, based upon that intellectual life, right? That whole human potential is being modified by the life carriers. You know, in an effort to get will creatures on every sphere possible, no matter how difficult that is, right? They will modify and modify to the edge of, if they modified any more, it could never be a will creature.
Right.
Right. They take it right up to that line. And so some of these extreme modifications, see, would involve making it so it's just barely able to even cross the threshold from animal to human, right? And so those mortals are starting at the very, very bottom, the most tenuous position to try to somehow end up on the Isle of Paradise eventually.
Do you think it's fair to say that out of all these types, we haven't read them all yet, but I think it's fair to say that, you know, all of them have a middle of the bell curve kind of thing, like 60% are this thing, 80% are this thing. Is that the part that didn't have to be tweaked? Is that the majority case of which we pretty much fall into, the normal, I guess?
Yeah, and even though, you know, we kind of just, yeah, technically, metaphorically speak of these things as a bell curve, sort of a distribution. Okay, it isn't literally a distribution that results from a random process.
No.
As you just emphasized with your sentence, right?
Right.
See, it's just that there is, a dominant central space in all of these spectrums of variation, where it is the mortals, are bounded a little bit above starting at the very bottom and trying to somehow get all the way to the top. But if you vary either direction from that, you can still make a mortal, but now it's going to be starting at an even greater deficit. It's going to require even more of a willful effort to overcome the feat of play and even get to the first Magic World. I mean, think about some of these worlds before you have the universal bestowal thought adjusters, right? Before that world gets a bestowal sun, right? I mean, it could potentially be, a rather low percentage that make it to the first mansion world because of how extremely marginally human they are.
Boy, that's very helpful, Chris. Yeah. It is quite impossible for you to envisage the environment which prevails during the early ages of some worlds. These unusual conditions make it necessary for the evolving animal life to remain in its marine nursery habitat for longer periods than on those planets which very early provide a hospitable land and atmosphere environment. Conversely, on some worlds of the superbreathers, when the planet is not too large, it is sometimes expedient to provide for a mortal type which can readily negotiate atmospheric passage. These air navigators sometimes intervene between the water and land groups, and they always live in a measure upon the ground, eventually evolving into land dwellers. But on some worlds, for ages, they continue to fly, even after they have become land-type beings. Well,
and notice, okay, I mean, again, why is there this quote-unquote center of these kind of bell curve-like distributions? I mean, it's because pattern, right, that's being downstepped, and that pattern is the material sons and daughters on the system headquarters world of, whatever local system you're talking about.
Yes,
right.
Right, and, they are, land type beings, period, right? There isn't even oceans on those worlds, right? So, the bias is in, is coming down from on high, right? And so the center of these distributions is the pattern on high, and then it diffuses, right, through life carrier manipulation, right, away from that central point, right, to either side.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so, and you can you can even see that in the way they on the one hand they're talking about marine and then they talk about air in the middle of the paragraph there and what word do they use to flip you right from one to the other? Conversely, right? It's like, well, we can rotate 180 degrees around the land central point from water to air. The land, because that's what material sons and daughters are about, is the central point here that you're rotating the verse part rotating about. So that's again the fundamental way that. You understand these spectra of diversity is the life carriers have a center point always. There's the original material son and daughter in each local system, and every life they design in a local system is based upon that center point. Right, and they're varying, relative to that central point. Right, they go to a different local system; it's a different central point, and they vary from that different central point.
Boy, yeah, I'm getting that. I'm just finding it impossible to envisage this. And I grew up nursed on a very unhealthy Cheetos-like diet of science fiction. So I just can't do it. Okay. And to have them be will creatures, that's what's crazy.
Yeah.
All right.
And as they're about to stress, we're not talking about you know, birds and fishes here.
It is both amazing and amusing to observe the early civilization of a primitive race of human beings taking shape in one case in the air and treetops, and in another midst the shallow waters of sheltered tropic basins, as well as on the bottom, sides, and shores of these marine gardens of the dawn races of such extraordinary spheres. Even on Urantia, there was a long age during which primitive man preserved himself and advanced his primitive civilization by living for the most part in the treetops, as did his earlier arboreal ancestors. And on Urantia, you still have a group of diminutive mammals, the bat family, that are air navigators, and your seals and whales of marine habitat are also of the mammalian order.
The one I want to know about is, as on the bottom, sides and shores. What's that about? That's like, that sounds so primitive.
Notice that what they stress here before, like even there, before they get to the bottom, sides and shores, okay, I mean, the point they're trying to make is you're thinking about trying to found civilization. See, and they're getting you to reflect on how there's a kind of a literalness of that. If the will creatures can't plant their feet firmly on the ground, you know, it's hard to anchor civilization. You know,
sure.
So, you know, they're trying to get you to imagine, okay, so you've got the ones that, you know, that are, you know, fundamentally in the air, okay, you can't plant your feet anywhere in the air, or the ones that are fundamentally floating in the midst of the water, you can't plant your feet there either. Okay, but at least, you know, the ones in the air have the trees to kind of plant, you know, found a civilization a little bit relative to the trees, and the ones in the water have, you know, the bottom, sides, and shores of that, you know, that water to kind of plant and found civilization relative to. But obviously, in both cases, it's going to be very limited to begin with. How much you can, you know, kind of dig your feet in and start running with civilization, because you just literally can't dig your feet in and run. Okay.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, the other thing too here, that last sentence where they bring up the bats and the seals and the whales and whatnot. You know how evolution has several different trajectories that it can take. Is that part of why they're bringing up this last sentence here? Because it could have gone a couple of different ways.
Well, you know, between the lines of that is, remember where this decimal world, where they loosen the constraints, and so instead of getting an evolution on this planet that would more definitively, express, over the whole span of that evolution, more definitively express the goal of, land dwellers, right, in a very definitive way, you see that the mammals, you know, are kind of diffusing away from that definitive line, and you're getting a little bit of the air type and the water type, you know, being expressed in a, you know, very minor way, right? Neither of those, you know, developed into, you know, sophisticated mammals that, you know, and, you know, were, you know, basically biologically compatible with, you know, Andon and Fonta.
No.
All the ones that were biologically compatible with the first humans, you know, those immediate subhumans, you know, were land creatures, right?
Okay.
As well, but just see, because of the loosening, you can. They're just saying, think about it. You can kind of tell that there's a potential, you know, that was kind of, you know, squeezing through the cracks here a little bit of going towards air or water.
And that's remember our italicized sentence of the evening, mortal man is not an evolutionary accident. If someone looks at whales and all they have is evolutionary accident, they just shrug and go, I don't know, I guess that's random, that just sort of happened. But they're saying,
I guess
no,
they
that's
just
an,
accidentally
that's an,
went back
into
the water.
Right. But they're saying, right. No, that's an echo from another type of situation that you're seeing, and you can think about it. Yeah.
Yeah. The only reason they could go back to the water like those mammals did is because innate, you know, in the overall potential are worlds where the will creatures are, you know, begin more definitively water and air. Otherwise, that retrograde couldn't have happened. Again, it
right.
has to be allowable within the mind energy system, right? The matter can't
right.
just go
yeah.
back to the water. The mind has to allow for that.
Yeah.
And if there weren't water and air types, right, the mind wouldn't allow for that. Those would have never gone back into the ocean like that. Because they could.
Because there's no potential. There's nothing for the system
right.
to work with, to drive, to, yeah. Huh.
See, so that's what, you know, it's between the lines of them pointing that out to us. It's like, you know, just think about it there a second. You know, reflect on it. You've got a little hint, you know, that what we're talking about here is the case. Even if, you know, it is, quote-unquote, quite impossible for you to envisage. Right, in any sort of direct way, nonetheless, he's going, but I can see. Right? You know, there wouldn't be bats if there wasn't, you know, a potential that is not, you know, that wasn't focused on here in the mind energy system to go to, you know, air-based will creatures. But again, like they stressed, you know, no matter when all is said and done, they have to end up on the land. Because everything and every being, right, every creature on every world, you know, is moving to become indistinguishable from an architectural world, right, when that world is deeply settled in light and life. There aren't, you know, air-based will creatures on architectural spheres. There aren't water-based will creatures on architectural spheres. So, again, everything is driven to the pattern.
Right.
And humans can rebel against that. You know, you're not the boss of me. If I want to diverge off any way I want, I'm just going to do it. It's like, you go ahead. The harder you push off the path, the more you evaporate until you just disappear as if you'd never been born. You play between the lines or you don't exist.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it there. I was about to bring up the really bad 1990s movie Waterworld in terms of retrograde evolution, but we don't need to bring up humans with gills. Let's just – someone tried to envision it, and it made a pretty bad movie, so let's just let that be.
Yeah. You know, and again, we're, you know, as they're going to stress, you know, don't start thinking, you know, mermaids here.
No. In Satania, of the elemental types, 7% are water, 10% air, 70% land, and 13% combined land and air types. But these modifications of early intelligent creatures are neither human fishes nor human birds. They are of the human and pre-human types, neither super fishes nor glorified birds, but distinctly mortal.
Right. So you don't build up super. You don't build up from the fishes, and you don't build up from the birds. You build up from mammals. Because material sons and daughters are mammals.
Yeah, that's not even between the lines right there. But, I mean, you know, to the extent it's between the lines, it's a huge hint. Like, mammals are what are mortals. Mortals are mammals, period.
Yeah, like bats and whales are mammals.
They are.
Right. See, that's, you know, they're bringing in that, right, so we can think about, oh, yeah, that's right. You could have air and water, you know, and still be fundamentally mammalian. Yeah, yeah. See, it's not some, you know, impossible thing to imagine.
And they're also emphasizing the diminutive mammals regarding bats to kind of paint the picture that Chris is unpacking right now.
Yeah. Not to mention, you know, in the whale category, you know, our favorite one like that is the dolphins. No, the dolphins don't have libraries, you know, under the sea.
No, they don't.
I have a close relative who believes that's true.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. There's always Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Right. So again, we have, what's reality and what's science fiction? Pleasing fables. Just one little quick thing. They brought up the whole issue about super breathers. You know, back a couple paragraphs there. In regard to ones that might be related to the air. Okay, but notice it's not even remotely any sort of a one-to-one correspondence, right? You know, what percentage were super breathers?
I just look back. It's pretty small.
5%. 5%.
Yeah.
Right? And what percent here are air?
10% here, but then another 13%, so 23%, almost a quarter.
Yeah,
right. See, we aren't sort of just talking about the same spectrum in a different way, right? I mean, these are all, to some degree kind of orthogonal, right? It's a very complex space that the life carriers are designing life in. Like, well, along this dimension, we've got this spectrum, and along this other dimension, we've got this spectrum.
And prior to the appearance of Will, they're making real-time modifications. They're making adjustments.
Yep. And there's you can imagine that on some of the more extreme worlds, it might require a lot more micromanagement.
Yes.
Right? To see to it that, you know, that the Will creatures can actually, you know, come through the other side, right? There'll be a lot of narrow necks, evolutionary necks that could easily be pinched off by the vicissitudes of the environment. And, they're going to have to carefully guide them through. And all of these, the extreme is, how incredibly artificial it's got to be on a non-breather world, where, you can see a lot of things they're saying, doesn't immediately include that exception, right? Or that exceptional fact. Like when they say, these unusual conditions make it necessary for the evolving animal life to remain in its marine nursery habitat for longer periods than on. Okay, there is no marine nursery on a non-breather world. There's no ocean, okay? It's got no atmosphere. There's no water. And so it's very different on a non-breather world.
It's somewhat humorous to me to imagine life carriers sitting around a campfire talking about their complaints of the one thing that keeps messing up their plans, like, oh, it's the volcanoes. Those volcanoes keep messing things. Like, there's got to be a handful of things that keep throwing them off, and they have to react to. It'd be really curious to flush that out.
Yeah, and again, the subtlest things, that we can't even really imagine, speculate about, like you can speculate about volcanoes or something, right? But, the subtlest things, are what they have to literally, why they have to do every 10 worlds, they have to do an experiment in a decimal world, right, where they, get a little bit of a sense of what the Supreme is up to, right? So, they're not too caught off guard. Right? They're always caught off guard to some degree, but there's a limit. And the way they prevent from it, going beyond that limit where it would short circuit their best efforts, is by doing an experiment every 10 worlds and getting a new values for some of the variables in their equations. Oh, that one is 6.38 now instead of 5.24. Okay. Right? I mean, you know, so our world, you know, allowed them to, you know, adjust their equations for the, you know, the next, you know, 10 worlds subsequent to us, you know, so that they, you know, don't end up being caught off guard, you know, where the Supreme throws something at them that they didn't, you know, build in a contingency for.
All right. Number three, the gravity types. By modification of creative design, intelligent beings are so constructed that they can freely function on spheres both smaller and larger than Urantia, thus being in measure accommodated to the gravity of those planets, which are not of ideal size and density.
Okay, just notice one sneaky little word in there. What? Ideal?
Yeah, it is interesting.
Ideal. Yeah, because again, remember, these name types impact the intellectual or the spiritual life. Spiritual life. The domain of ideals.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Right. And again, like I said, you push these, you know, you push away from the center with these various modes of modification, and you know, you can take it to the point where there's just no way to for the creative mother's spirit to create an upper domain to that animal origin mind, a domain of potential ideals.
Well, they wouldn't set it up like that, would they?
No, they won't, right? Yeah, because the whole point is great will creatures.
Right.
But just remind you that as you push away from the center. I mean, there's a reason why material sons and daughters are where they are. You know, that optimizes all this, right? In terms of them being will creatures.
You wonder
if you push away from that center point in any different direction. Right, it becomes more and more tenuous, right? To get an
but
actual
by the time we're,
human.
By the time we're all finaliters, that's all evened out and smoothed out, and we're all at the same stage.
All
right?
Of this is transcended basically by the time you get to the third dimension world.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Sorry,
you wonder,
I interrupted you there.
In the same way that you have the angels of progress and the angels of the churches, you wonder if there are sort of groups of life carriers that are more interested in pushing the limits and others that are more interested in conserving the mean.
Yeah, but don't even get close to thinking the way, you know, that in parallel to the Lennon index in that regard.
No.
The life carriers, you know, are firm on staying between the lines. The Lennon index, you don't have issues with lines.
Yeah.
Why can't I call her outside the lines? You know, said Lucifer and Caligastia.
Said no life carrier ever, yeah.
Yeah, said no life carrier ever. Yeah.
Right. The various planetary types of mortals vary in height, the average in Nevadon being a trifle under 7 feet. Some of the larger worlds are peopled with beings who are only about 2.5 feet in height. Mortal stature ranges from here on up through the average heights on the average-sized planets to around 10 feet on the smaller inhabited spheres. In Satania, there is only one race under 4 feet in height. 20% of the Satania-inhabited worlds are peopled with mortals of the modified gravity types occupying the larger and the smaller planets.
Notice it's kind of interesting that they gave you a little less specificity here. Apparently they weren't allowed to get too precise on this one. You know, they just say, well, the stuff away from the middle is 20%.
20%, yeah.
Okay. It's like, well, how much is on the smaller side? How much, you know, the shorter side? How much is on the taller side? Okay, they don't give you those specifics. They give you that one little hint about, you know, they not, so far there haven't been any that were, you know, super short, you might say, right?
Right.
But you know, that's just kind of a little interesting little, you know, side note there, that there's some sort of limitation on them talking about this one a little bit. You know, now remember, you know, when you're talking about material sons and daughters, you know, actually on this, on a system headquarters world, and before they get selected as an Adam and Eve and brought and downstepped, right? You know, they're 8 to 10 feet.
Right.
Yep. So, you know, see, notice how it's maxing out, you know, with material sons and daughters maxing out.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so that's a, you know, if people are wondering where that is, you know, it's a couple papers ahead in the Planetary Atoms one in Section 1, paragraph, what is that, paragraph 3, material suns vary in height from 8 to 10 feet. Yeah, so again, you know, it's, you know, you can have it so that in terms of height, the material son and daughter selected as an Adam and Eve wouldn't have to be downstepped in height at all, right? And even then, you know, if the Adam and Eve don't mate directly, it's only their further downstepped offspring, yeah, you can still have an Adam and Eve that's quite significantly of, you know, greater stature than the creatures on the world they go to. Yeah, and they're definitely going to probably be, you know, quite a bit taller, you know, if it's one of these high gravity worlds.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it seems like at some point it could just, the shortness of people on high gravity worlds is just because the frame can't handle it, too much gravity.
Yeah.
But you're thinking that the Adams and Eves could, their frame could handle it. They could be taller and still endure that gravity. I mean, they were able to
be
8 feet
you know,
tall here.
I would
here.
Guess they'd be a bit taller, but see, their offspring, you know, would be, you know, 2.5 feet in height, you know.
Right, right.
The Adamson on that world, right, would be right about 2.5 feet high. You know, or thereabouts. I mean, you know, again, they might be a little bit taller because the whole point is to you know, there's some biologic upstepping going on. You know, you can even see with the average being a trifle under 7 feet, right? Even though the Adam and Eve are downstepped from the system headquarters, still, it's kind of hinting at, you know, kind of a literalness of biologic upstepping. Right, the kind of influence that they're bringing down.
Boy,
I know in this. In
I
this
find
arc,
myself.
Sorry, Brad. Go ahead.
Oh well, I was just thinking, like, you know, we're used to the scale and size of our world, which is big, but it's comprehensible. But imagine being only 2.5 feet tall on a world that is bigger than ours. So your stride isn't very big. So, like, you just can't get anywhere very fast by land, and your planet is huge. Like, your whole sense of the scale of the universe would be vastly different. Now I'm beginning to understand the effect on the intellectual life, at least.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And just see how much stimulus you have to, you know, manage your life personally, you know. You know, separate from, you know, the capacity to do it.
Yeah,
so all these issues are in play. I mean, our world, you know, if you've got, you know, humans that are, you know, getting up, you know, around the 6 foot range, you know, you're going, okay, that's showing some signs of some biologic upstepping. There's some andite blood there, right? Except for the giant streams, you know, coming from the orange and the green.
Yeah.
Right, which again, you know, was kind of topping out at 8-9 feet.
Does the book talk about anywhere how I just find it so fascinating that we have these seasons and we have you know, 24 hours in the day, and we have light and dark and all of these things that sort of frame our life and give us boundaries that that shape us. And I wonder if it's true with these other worlds where they have similar things like that. But
no,
can we talk about it anyway?
It's going to be all over the map. Like you can tell from, you know, if they have to modify the morals this much, I mean, think about how much the environment, you know, is different on these different worlds. I mean, so you know, you have mortals that are raised in just a completely different environment, you know, then, you know, like I said, I mean, in, you know, in a lot of cases, we can't even imagine how different the environment is. And so, again, how much different those will creatures are stimulated.
And yet, there still has to be some sort of a construct that's there to give their life the rhythm that it needs. I'm not sure rhythm is the right word, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, again, these you know, sort of the physical expression of, you know, the inevitabilities.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Is the exercise of will desirable? Well, then must there be some sort of stimulus that drives you in that direction? I mean, you know, why did Andon and Fonta instinctively go north away from the salubrious climes? Right, because is the exercise of will desirable? Then must you not be in salubrious climes. Right? You need to be facing death at the face of the glacier.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay.
Otherwise, you know, there's going to be no stimulus. I mean, and no one is going to survive on that world. No one will exercise will at all, and every one of them will, you know, will just be drops of water in the ocean. You know, they won't survive. We have to be talented.
Okay. Right. Okay. Thank you.
Justin, would you like to take the reading from here?
Sure thing. Thanks, Brett. Number 4, the temperature types. It is possible to create living beings who can withstand temperatures both much higher and much lower than the life range of the Urantia races. There are 5 distinct orders of beings as they are classified with reference to heat-regulating mechanisms. In this scale, the Urantia races are number 3. 30% of Satania worlds are peopled with races of modified to higher temperature ranges, 18% to the lower, as compared with Urantians, who function in the mid-temperature group.
They didn't flesh that one totally out, but a little bit more, right? You know, we get a little sense of, you know, how asymmetric it is about the 30%. Just again, notice those little details. I mean, it's just kind of fodder for speculation. Like, I wonder why they didn't. I mean, sometimes they flesh it all out really precisely, and other times, there's some underlying mystery there.
Number 5, the electric types. The electric, magnetic, and electronic behavior of the world varies greatly. There are 10 designs of mortal life variously fashioned to withstand the differential energy of the spheres. These 10 varieties also react in slightly different ways to the chemical rays of ordinary sunlight. But these slight physical variations in no way affect the intellectual or the spiritual life.
See how they've made a point of reminding us about these named types here that it's about, you know, affecting the intellectual and spiritual life. But, you know, within that, if you're talking about, you know, different ways that the bodies, you know, react to ultraviolet, okay, that's, you know, that's kind of in that unnamed type sort of, you know, lesser significance. But the electric type, you know, directly is very consequential, again, to the intellectual or the spiritual life. And you want to think about here when they're talking about electric, magnetic, and electronic. In other words, if there's we're talking about particles, the presence of electric and magnetic influence, in general. And there's two things to think about, right? All encompassing with those three. On the one hand, there's issues about the world itself. And on the other hand, there's issues of the environment that world is in, the greater cosmic environment that world, that solar system exists in. Right? It could be in a region of the galaxy, right, that where there's a lot of, large-scale interstellar electric and magnetic influence, or, it could be around a star that has a lot of, solar wind that, has to be dealt with. It could be, in an area where there's lots of, sun cosmic rays. And right, there's all these issues that they've got to deal with. The great variability and the great sensitivity. I mean, you literally have 10 different flavors here, right, to deal with it. You can't sort of just, one size kind of fits all here. It's like, no, not at all. You got to break it up into very, tiny, relatively tiny, divisions here.
Of the electric groupings of mortal life, almost 23% belong to class number 4, the Urantia type of existence. These types are distributed as follows. Number 1, 1%. Number 2, 2%. Number 3, 5%. Number 4, 23%. Number 5, 27%. Number 6, 24%. Number 7, 8%. Number 8, 5%. Number 9, 3%. Number 10, 2%. In whole percentages. That's
so
interesting.
Give you all 10. Now, to give you a little bit of a sense, notice how it's lopsided, right, to, the higher numbered types. In other words, to the, the more energetic side of the spectrum here. That's because, like they'll remind us at the beginning of Section 3, Satania is in, a relatively, energetic part, not only of, of Norlacia Deck, but, of the galaxy in general, the super universe in general. So, not surprisingly, you have a lopsidedness there. Not a lot of worlds, are kind of on the benign side.
Yeah, I guess I follow that. I guess I'm wondering, over the super long term, don't all those space conditions change because things revolve? And I don't know, I guess space goes along with you, but I'm just also thinking over billions of years, space itself evolves. But maybe
we're just talking about evolutionary life here, we're not talking about
right.
worlds and light and life, right?
Well, I guess, once you get to light and life, you're completely managed anyway. All these electric types, all these types here are a part of your heritage, but they're no longer informing the mortal beings walking around. They've reached the ideal. They look like a material son and daughter.
Yeah. Right. This is just what the life carriers have to deal with to get will creatures on the world and to have those will creatures, be able to manage, the various conditions, until power beings begin to, in the fifth stage of light and life, start to super, super take control of everything, right?
Right.
Taking control of the star that's their sun and, all kinds of things, right? Okay. But before that, it is what it is, and they have to, face it.
The energizing types. Not all worlds are alike in the manner of taking in energy. Not all inhabited worlds have an atmospheric ocean suited to respiratory exchange of gases such as is present on Urantia. During the earlier and the later stages of many planets, beings of your present order could not exist. And when the respiratory factors of a planet are very high or very low, but when all other prerequisites to intelligent life are adequate, the life carriers often establish on such worlds a modified form of mortal existence, beings who are competent to affect their life process exchanges directly by means of light energy and the first-hand power transmutations of the master physical controllers.
Yep. Notice in there, Brad, about during the earlier, which is, and the later stages.
Right. Why would, later? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Right. That's getting at, there's a little exception to what I was saying before, okay? Because after all, there's some worlds that are just a non-breather world in the seventh stage of light and life, okay? And so, you could have a world where it may start out, wonderful, but, those conditions change with time, and it's kind of maybe moving more and more towards a non-breather sort of a world or something, and that's just needs to be, right? I mean, it all depends on what the master physical controllers can change and what they can't, or maybe eventually, when the super universe is settled in light and life, they can change some things, right, or thereabouts. Okay, but, not in the time frame of a world, getting to light and life itself. Right? So there's these bigger issues that they're alluding to there, right, that you might have to design the life on the world with the future in mind, not just the present. Very complicated.
Yeah.
And right, and when we're talking about, obviously they're thinking about something kind of like photosynthesis somewhere at the end, the light energy. Okay. But the biggie, right, is the master physical controllers. And let's just take one quick moment to go back to paper 29, section 4, right, which is about the master physical controllers. Right. And you scroll, remember there's seven types, scroll down in there till you get to type number 4, the energy transmitters. It's on page 327, the single column. Look at that last paragraph about the energy transmitters. These are impersonal, beings here, if you will, entities.
Right.
These energy transmitters. You can use beings in a generalized sense here. Right? These beings, together with the energy transformers, so the group number 3 that they talked about right before this, which are very a personal type. So these beings, together with the energy transformers, are indispensable to the maintenance of mortal existence on those worlds having an impoverished atmosphere. You get into the sub-breather stuff, okay? And they are an integral part of the technique of life on the non-breathing planets. Right? So either to a high degree or totally, right, the energy input into the will creatures is purely coming from the master physical controllers. The master physical controllers are pumping energy into each individual will creature, or in each animal too, right, on those worlds. Right. The animal, the little creature, the human doesn't, get it, do energy input themselves by like sticking something in your pie hole.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh.
Purely fed, quote unquote, by the master physical controllers. I mean, specifically, the energy transmitters with, the assistance of the energy transformers. Right. You're plugged into the energy transmitters. Right.
Wow.
So think how different the Last Supper is on a world like that.
I think the picture could still be the same, though.
or your pleasing fable from the Urantia book, and you're like, well, I want to be one of the corporeal staff of a planetary prince because I just want to relive my mortal life again. Imagine waking up and being one of these. I don't know.
All right.
Yep.
So. So it's just, you know, that's what they're alluding to there. I mean, and it's just, you know, giving quite extreme.
Yeah.
I speculate and envisage sparsity in terms of the sheer number of animals and life in general when these master physical controllers are engaging will creatures at that level. I imagine there to be a lot less stuff going on.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of blades of grass on the planet Earth, you know, and every one of them is minded by, you know, that second type of master physical controllers and mechanical controllers. So, you know, they're ubiquitous, remember. So they can handle a lot.
There are six differing types of animal and mortal nutrition. The sub-breathers employ the first type of nutrition, the marine dwellers the second, the mid-breathers the third, as on your rancha. The super-breathers employ the fourth type of energy intake, while the non-breathers utilize the fifth order of nutrition and energy. The sixth technique of energizing is limited to the midway creatures.
And there, we're just talking about secondary midwayers. How do you know that? If you go to the end of paper 38, it's talking about the midway creatures. You know, they tell you that primary midwayers are energized intellectually and spiritually by the angelic technique. Okay, so that's, you know, not what we're talking about here. The secondary midwayers are physically energized by the Adamic technique, spiritually encircled by the Seraphic, you know, kind of like we get encircled in the Holy Spirit, okay? But, you know, see, that's what they're talking about. The secondaries are physically energized by the Adamic technique, okay? Now, not literally downstepped material sons and daughters as Adam and Eve, not that technique, no tree of life, no shrub of Adentia, right? But, you know, the way the material sons and daughters are energized on, you know, the headquarters, system headquarters world. You know, in the other system headquarters worlds. They're being fed, again, by the master physical controllers, in part.
Seven, the unnamed types. There are numerous additional physical variations in planetary life, but all of these differences are wholly matters of anatomical modification, physiologic differentiation, and electrochemical adjustment. Such distinctions do not concern the intellectual or the spiritual life.
Yeah. So then, you know, the kind of things that, you know, a sci-fi encyclopedia of possible, you know, alien life, okay, you know, they're imagining matters of anatomical modification and physiologic differentiation and electrochemical adjustment. Okay, but in the real universe, that's a minor issue. Right? The real issue is, you know, modifications that affect the intellectual or the spiritual life, because the universe exists for will creatures.
Right.
You know, not snails.
Andrea, would you like to take over the reading from here?
Sure, thank you. Worlds of the non-breathers. The majority of inhabited planets are peopled with the breathing type of intelligent beings, but there are also orders of mortals who are able to live on worlds with little or no air. Of the Orvontan inhabited worlds, this type amounts to less than 7%. In Nebadon, this percentage is less than 3%. In all Satania, there are only 9 such worlds.
Okay, you know, yeah, 7%, 3%, okay, you know, but, yeah, think, you know, about numbers for a second, okay? You know, if that, you know, 7%, roughly 7% holds until all is said and done, you know, in the 7th super universe in Orvontan, okay, there's going to be a trillion inhabited worlds, okay, and 70 billion of them
will
be non-breather worlds.
Well, that's crazy.
70 billion, okay, in just our super universe.
Wow.
Okay. So, When you think about it like that, it's a lot of worlds, right?
It is. This is not as abnormal, or it is radical. It is extreme, but it is not. It's really just not rare. It's a perfectly decent way for life to get along. Right.
Yeah. Right. So, this may be, radical, extreme. Okay, but it's obviously very, very fundamental to the grand universe scheme.
Yeah, there's something to it.
You can't produce the grand universe settled enlightened life unless you have, something like 70 billion non-breather worlds in orbit time.
Oh, that's so strange, yeah.
Okay.
Like, why? Why? I just can't understand why that would be necessary.
We'll get a little bit of an answer to that question here in a minute.
Yeah, one quick thing to throw out there, Andrea, is it allows a little bit of a training opportunity for the father fragments. That's one thing that it does.
Yeah. Okay. And of course, the whole, planetary mortal ethics are so fascinating to try to imagine on a non-breather world. The Adam and Eve coming there and they have to be able to procreate offspring that can mate with non-breathers, right?
Wow.
The stole sun coming to this world, et cetera, right? Yeah.
There are so very few of the non-breather type of inhabited worlds in Satania because this more recently organized section of Norlaisha Deck still abounds in meteoric space bodies, and worlds without a protective friction atmosphere are subject to incessant bombardment by these wanderers. Even some of the comets consist of meteor swarms, but as a rule they are disrupted smaller bodies of matter. Okay.
As you get a little bit about that, okay, but like I was hinting before, right, about that, how it was biased to the higher energy sort of environments. This is where they're pointing at that. It's not just, large stuff like meteoric size stuff, but the entire energy environment is, very active in our neck of the woods.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why some of those worlds, even if they have an atmosphere, you've got to, the life carriers have to design and to be able to handle that sort of an environment. Like maybe a lot more elements are radioactive on a lot of these worlds.
Hmm.
The level of background radioactivity on a lot of these worlds might be, quite high.
Yeah. Millions upon millions of meteorites enter the atmosphere of Urantia daily, coming in at the rate of almost 200 miles a second. On the non-breathing world, the advanced races must do much to protect themselves from meteor damage by making electrical insulation, which operate to consume or shunt the meteors. Great danger confronts them when they venture beyond these protected zones. These worlds are also subject to disastrous electrical storms of a nature unknown on Urantia. During such times of tremendous energy fluctuation, the inhabitants must take refuge in their special structures of protective insulation. It makes you wonder how they were able to get things rolling to create these protective
That's obviously between the lines. Before there were will creatures on that planet, and they were just animals. The animals didn't build secure underground installations to protect them from the harsh environment. Right? These worlds, when they terraform these worlds, it's not to give them a breathable atmosphere and stuff. Okay, it's to build all kinds of underground facilities, in which life is going to be possible.
I see. Okay.
Your imagination can run wild.
It sounds dark.
Very different sort of a evolutionary environment here. And you know, everyone knows that, you know, right in the middle there, consume or shunt. You've heard me talk about this section before. You know, by consume, they mean, you know, that they're working against, you know, the meteor. But shunt means they're working with it. It's like, well, what does it mean to work with it? Well, that you know, why is the meteor falling in to the planet? Because of gravity. Right? That's, you know, that's what's, you know, going on there, to work with the gravity, you know, and have it not hit the planet. Okay, that's anti-gravity. They have, you know, electromagnetic installations where they're producing artificial gravity and, you know, shunting those meteors away. So they have very advanced technology, anti-gravity technology and whatnot.
Okay. Tractor beams. All right. We got it. Got Star Trek.
Life on the world of the non-breathers is radically different from what it is on Urantia. The non-breathers do not eat food or drink water, as do the Urantia races. The reactions of the nervous system, the heat-regulating mechanism, and the metabolism of these specialized peoples are radically different from such functions of Urantia mortals. Almost every act of living, aside from reproduction, differs, and even the methods of procreation are somewhat different.
Yeah, talk about a radically modified mammal here.
What's the difference then between
water? Go ahead. What do you say?
Reproduction and between reproduction and procreation.
Well, I mean, no, they're just saying it in two different ways.
I see. Okay.
You can envision, you know, what they have to do to reproduce, right? That's not hard to imagine, okay?
Right.
But the whole mechanism of procreation, right, you know, down in the details, okay, there's differences, okay?
Okay, all right.
And
they're not using a suitable salt solution for the basis of their life. I mean...
right.
And so precede you.
Yeah, right. Just think about how radically different things have to be. Right. I mean, what a cell is and whatnot. You can see the heat regulating thing. You know, we were just talking about that, you know, that type. And right, so all these various, you know, modalities are in play. It's just so difficult to try to imagine how this all works.
Sorry about that. On the non-breathing worlds, the animal species are radically unlike those found on the atmospheric planet. The non-breathing plan of life varies from the technique of existence on an atmospheric world. Even in survival, their peoples differ, being candidates for spirit fusion. Nevertheless, these beings enjoy life and carry forward the activities of the realm with the same relative trials and joys that are experienced by the mortals living on atmospheric worlds. In mind and character, the non-breathers do not differ from other mortal types.
Okay, so, you know, we talked about how those named types, you know, affect the intellectual or the spiritual life. Yes. Okay, but, you know, here are the mind and character of the non-breathers, right, do not differ. Okay, I mean, you know, they have adjutant mind just like we do.
Sure. Right?
That's what I mean by that. They have seven adjutants, you know, and character there in circuit, and the Holy Spirit, and the personality identifies to it, you know. So, you know, the basic hourglass analogy understanding of their mindal self is, you know, just like ours. Okay, that doesn't differ. But, you know, the details within that hourglass analogy, mindal self, okay, are very different. Matter of fact, they're so different in the upper domain, right, that they can't fuse with a thought adjuster. They're spirit fusers. Right? See, so you so modified the spiritual life that, you know, that they can't fuse with a thought adjuster. That's how much they're modified. And they can still survive, right, but only by spirit fusion. You know, and that gets back to that opening paragraph here in this section. You know, why would we need 70 billion non-breather worlds in Orvinton, say? Well, yeah, you need a lot of spirit fusers,
right,
to handle the basic, you know, within local universe issues. You know, everyone can't just be passing through. I'm out of here.
Yeah.
And the non-breathers are a big part of that foundation of internal local universe, you know, life.
You know, those aliens that they have supposedly found here and there, and that they call the grays with the big eyes, and they don't seem to have breathing apparatuses. You got to wonder if that's what they're talking about here, those sorts of beings.
Go way off on that tangent, you know. But yeah, just think about, you know, they don't need a functioning mouth, they don't need a functioning nose, they don't need functioning ears. I mean, they'll have them because you have a basic, you know, life type.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's very obvious. We're talking about non-breathers there.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Last paragraph. You would be more than interested in the planetary conduct of this type of mortal, because such a race of beings inhabits a sphere in close proximity to Urantia.
Okay, and you know, everyone knows I love to emphasize, you know, a couple things here. It doesn't say you'd be interested. Okay, you know, we're interested in, you know, talking about all this stuff. We've been doing it for 2 hours here. Okay, it says more than interested. What does that mean? And then not only more than interested, but in the planetary conduct. It's like, like the planetary conduct of, you know, as a planetary phenomenon, you know, they're engaging our world because they've been, you know, asked to come and help out the secondary midwares. Okay.
How are you getting that from the word planetary conduct?
Well, I'm giving you some thought for speculation, right? We don't have 2 hours to talk about it here, right? But just, you know, in close proximity. Remember, they tell you that there were 12 planets that formed out of that tongue of matter from the Angana system, pulling it off the sun. We can carefully observe the solar system now in quite a bit of detail. There's 11. Where's the 12th? Right? And why is there one missing in between Pluto and Eris? Right? There's an obvious gap where there ought to be that 12th, you know, that 11th, technically, right? Of the 12. Right? I mean, yeah, this close proximity is if they're in our solar system, right? And they're right out there outside the Kuiper Belt on a world that we can't see because they have all this advanced technology, and they're keeping, you know, they're not letting sunlight reflect off of it and back to us yet. One of these days, we'll sync up with them, and then we'll be able to see their planet in the sky with a telescope.
Yeah. And what a party it's going to be. We probably won't be around for it. And, gosh, as much as it pains me to say, we'll have to leave it there. Listeners are like, but that's the best part. To be continued. We'll see you back here next week to be continued, I'm sure, in some discussion. So until then, follow the way.
Take care, everyone.
Good night, everyone.
Yes, definitely, as Brad said. Yeah, we will. We'll pick up this conversation. We can flesh it out. I'll give everyone a week to ponder some of these mysteries, and we'll see if we can explore some a little bit in greater detail at the beginning of the broadcast next week. So, tune in then, and we'll talk about non-breeders and everything else. Bye now.